From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. We have Paul Pronovo, editor of the Cape Cod Times, on the line. We usually check in with him monthly for our regional local news roundup. There's a lot of news coming out of the Cape this week. Paul, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here, Callie.
Let's start with the Pilgrim nuclear plant. The power was knocked out during the blizzard, but it's now back online.
Well, yeah, and of course, this raises the specter of some concerns people have had right along about the plant. The Pilgrim plant just went through a relicensing process over the past year or so, and a lot of critics had come forward asking for Pilgrim not to be relicensed. They made their pitch to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission essentially to have it fall on deaf ears. The NRC did, in fact, grant Pilgrim its relicense in June, but folks are concerned that every now and then the power, all our power goes off, but at the plant it sometimes goes off for one reason or another. It was not an emergency per se, but a precaution that was taken, and this has, again, happened from time to time for different reasons, and the folks at the plant who run it, the company called Entergy, said that there was nothing to be concerned about. This was routine matter of a switch that they just shut down right away to make sure that everything stays safe. So they say they're doing everything right and being very conservative in how they handle it. And so even though the plant will shut down from time to time, people shouldn't be concerned. But again, critics say, look what's happened elsewhere. They point to Fukushima and say that this is the sort of thing they don't want to happen here. So in the mix of all our wintry news, that was one of the events that happened this week.
Well, in fact, as you note in your piece, the plant's backup diesel generators kicked on twice during the storm. They automatically shut down at 9:17 on Friday. That was the first day of the storm, but they went kicked on twice, I guess, just to respond to the intensity of the storm.
Right, and Plymouth, the way this storm came in, Plymouth and just over the canal in Sandwich, really took the brunt of the weather. I mean, the wind was coming in that direction. The snow was, I think, heavier and more intense than a lot of folks anticipated. We knew it was going to be a pretty bad storm, but I think the amount of heavy, wet snow that fell in that area was overwhelming, and that went for Pilgrim, and frankly, it went for all the communities.
Right. And, you know, just to note for people who are concerned about this, the Entergy folks do point out that the generators have enough fuel to last for more than a week. If it came to that, it didn't come to that, but, you know, that's a backup safety factor as well.
Exactly. And you know, again, it's sort of like you wearing a belt and having suspenders. There's a lot of backup systems when you have a plant such as Pilgrim, and that's what the Entergy folks stressed. But the critics, they have a hard time buying that the plant is safe. They've made all sorts of cases through the years, and especially this year leading up to the relicensing. So they just simply are concerned, and Entergy, and I think a lot of nuclear plant owners are fairly tight-lipped about how things operate. So they have to sort of let you know when a plant shuts down, but people wonder if there's more behind the curtain, so to speak, and we just don't know.
Well, some folks that do believe that there's more behind the curtain are the people that protested at the nuclear power station in May 2012, and now they're scheduled to go on trial in March.
Right, and it's interesting because they you know, as these cases go, it was not a serious matter. It was essentially a trespassing case. But these folks want to go to trial. They could have certainly pled their way out of this case long ago. But they want to go to trial basically to shine a light on the situation they feel that's going on at the plant. They have long contended that Cape Cod, for example, does not have an adequate evacuation plan. And when you think about the logistics of the Cape, of course, there's no matter what, any event, there's a bottleneck. We have only two bridges on and off. So if you have a high volume of people trying to go in one direction at the same time, you're going to have a real jam. Folks are concerned about that. They're also concerned, of course, about the notion that the Sagamore Bridge, if there was an accident at the Pilgrim plant, would likely be shut down and everything would be pushed toward the Bourne Bridge. Because, of course, if you go over the Sagamore Bridge, you're heading right into Plymouth. So you don't want to head toward a problem. You want to push people away. Well, of course, now if you take two bridges and you limit it to one, that's a major issue. And that's just one of the topics that they want to have raised. There's been frustration at the local level, that grassroots protester level you mentioned, but also even in the government level. I know Senate President Therese Murray has spoken many times to us about her frustration trying to get heard and get answers from the NRC relative to Pilgrim. And, you know, that's just sort of the dynamic at play here. And that's why the protesters want to go to trial. They want to use this sort of as an opportunity, a soapbox, if you will, to let people know some of their concerns.
Well, three members of the group did a plea deal, so they got their charges dismissed and maybe they had to pay a small fine. But right. Is there any chance that these people, when even though they want to make their point and get to court to make their point, once there, well, that their charges might be dismissed?
It of course, is possible. I think these folks have been in this protest game a long time. The individuals are old school 60s style protesters, and they know how to do it, and they're very committed to their cause. In fact, we had them in they're called the Cape Downwinders, and they were into our editorial board not too long ago, unrelated to their court case. They were talking about some of their concerns with us, and you know they have a lot of information, and they know how to use tactics to get attention. And once they get attention, they hope that what they have for info is going to help make their case. So yes, it's possible that these other folks could plead out, but I think they're looking forward to, as you say, their day in court.
Yeah. All right. Well, still responding from the storm are folks that, as of yesterday anyway, according to your reporting, are without electricity. There are 741 people in Sandwich without electricity still.
Right. The number, as the hours go by, the number comes down, but very, very incrementally. The Cape really got blasted with power outages from the storm. Of course, the whole greater Boston area saw higher snow totals than you saw on the Cape. But the Cape, because it was raining so much and because the Cape, generally speaking, is warmer, so the snow is wet and heavy, exactly the kind of snow that will take down power lines. And I think at the height of the storm, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 130,000 people or customers were without power. And that's, of course, huge. And when you think the context is, I think the Cape only has about 200,000 total
wow.
electricity customers. So, I mean, the vast majority of people were in the dark and without heat. That was growing old already on Saturday.
Yeah,
but by Sunday and Monday, I mean, it was really starting to get tiresome. And folks who were trying to, you know, do that good old New Englander thing and gut it out and keep the fireplace stoked and go to bed early, you know, eventually they had to leave their homes because it just got too cold. And as you said, there's a few hundred scattered throughout the Cape. The number actually, it's interesting, is going up and down as the week has gone on. I think sometimes branches that didn't fall are now falling, and now they're hitting some wires and creating new problems for NSTAR. But it's almost house by house now in their restoration efforts. And unlike last year, where I think the power companies heard a lot of complaints from individual customers, from state officials, here I don't think people are blaming the folks at NSTAR, and NSTAR is what services Cape Cod. They understand that they've been out working incredibly long hours, out in the teeth of the storm, looking to restore power as fast as possible. But just the sheer numbers of people who were out made it impossible for them to get everybody back right away. So they're almost to the tail end of this, and I think the last few folks are looking forward to power flickering back on as soon as possible.
In the meantime, there are some serious impacts on institutions. For one thing, the kids in Sandwich, I didn't realize this, their classes are going to be shut down until February 25th at the earliest. That's
right.
a long time.
It sure is, Callie. You know, next week is February vacation, so in Massachusetts, public school kids were going to be out anyway. In Sandwich, they essentially got an extra week off. Now, you could look at that as glass half full or glass half empty. If you're one of the kids out sledding, probably glass half full. If you're one of the parents who had to take a week off from work in order to be home with their kids, glass half empty. And certainly from the school department's point of view, it's not good news because obviously they still have to get in their 180 days of school time in this calendar year. I think they can't go any longer than July 1, so they're going to have to get these days in. But frankly, they had no choice. There's been serious damage to the Oak Ridge Elementary School in town. In fact, I think state officials are going to be touring the school today to take a look at the problems. At the high school, they lost the generator, and so the kids can't be in school when you have these major problems. So the school department did the only thing they could. They canceled school, and parents are doing the only thing they can, which is go home and deal with your kids one more week.
Well, that's going to hit them where it hurts a little bit closer to summer, I can tell you right now. I'm talking to Paul Pronovo, editor of the Cape Cod Times on the line, and we're talking about a news roundup from the Cape. We've been talking about the Pilgrim plant shutdown and now back online. It was off briefly during the blizzard and many other events that have impacted the Cape because of it's really taking a hit, the biggest hit in Massachusetts during the blizzard, what some call a blizzard. In fact, Dave Epstein from Boston.com, who's a meteorologist, says it wasn't a blizzard in Boston, but down your way, it actually was. So you got the real blizzard. So speaking of that, in addition to the schools and the kids being shut out in Sandwich until February 25th, the Barnstable District Court has been having a hard time staying open because there's no heat, and it's crazy in there, but you can't work if people are in there with coats on.
Right. I think Barnstable was closed on Monday because they're still digging out, but once they got back up and running, they were on generator power, which meant they essentially had very little, if any, heat in the building, and the court workers were, you know, bundled up in their coats. It looked like a scene out of Christmas Carol. It was a very Bob Cratchit like scene where they are all bundled up with their gloves and their scarves, and because the show must go on. I mean, we had to reopen for business, and certainly the court system has to reopen for business. So that's what they did. They didn't have the luxury, as some private businesses did, of simply shutting down until power was completely restored. Of course, those private businesses lose business, so it's not something they're looking forward to doing. But this is kind of a quiet time anyway. But the courts didn't have that luxury. So they stayed open. They fought through it. And I think at this point it's starting to return to normal. But it really has been sort of a long dig out from the storm. I know a lot of folks down here are comparing it to the blizzard of 78 in terms of the damage that's been done, the power outages, the conditions of the roadways, the size of the snowbanks, and of course erosion, which is a big issue down here.
Well, you know, you have to remember that it hasn't been quite a week yet since the storm.
Right.
So it's given its impact, that's a lot. So let's talk about Paul Pronovo. A couple of ongoing stories that you and I have certainly talked about on our weekly roundup. The Mashpee Wampanoags claim for land, which is going to make it possible for them to build a casino, or at least this is a first concrete step. You can give the background, but what's been holding this up is federal approval for the Mashpees to be able to move forward. And now they just got something from the feds that really is a big boost to their claim.
Yeah, and I think some critics were actually surprised that this step even happened. The tribe has a long way to go, but where they are now is a big, as you said, Callie, a big step forward in their bid to have a $500 million casino. And the background is basically this. The tribe, the Mashpee Wampanoag, are in and about the town of Mashpee, which makes sense, but they have claims to have connections to other communities throughout southeastern Massachusetts, one of those being just happens to be the town, the city rather, of Taunton. Coincidentally, that's where they want to build their casino. So they had to essentially convince the federal government that they should be able to use land, I think it's about 167 acres, in the city of Taunton for a, quote, reservation. And, of course, that reservation would ultimately, they hope at least, would ultimately house a casino. Critics said they're never going to be able to convince them because there's so many small tribes in and around the Bay State. There's a lot of infighting, politically speaking, between the tribes. And so some believed the Mashpee Wampanoag wouldn't be able to achieve a recognition. Well, they are all but there. It seems that the Bureau of Indian Affairs this past week has given them the initial go-ahead. It's not a, I guess you'd say it's in pencil, not pen, that they can move forward to take the land as a reservation. That is, doesn't necessarily achieve their ultimate goal, which is to take land into federal trust, but it's a real big signal that that's what's going to happen. And I think both supporters and critics alike acknowledge that this is the direction it seems to be going. And that's really is a big boost for the Mashpee Wampanoag, who have had their, as we've talked about, Kelly, have their ups and downs as they pursue casino interests. They're in this race with other casino developers in the other portions of Massachusetts. This is a big step forward for the Mashpee Wampanoag. And it's interesting that even if ultimately they don't get to have a full-scale casino on that property, they, just by what this ruling indicates, they should be able to have slot parlors, which is a big part of any casino, because that's a Class 2 designation. They're looking for the Class 3, which is the whole thing. But Class 2 gets them almost there, so this is a big move for them.
And I note that it also relieves some of their financial backers, because there's a lot of money on the table. They've borrowed a lot. So if they didn't start to get this federal approval, so much money was just going to go the way of the ether, I guess. I mean, I don't know what was going to happen there. But that was they had a lot on the line here.
Yeah, I mean, you can't use the gambling analogy too much, right? I mean,
right.
They have these investors who put the money forward, knowing that it may or may not pay off in the end. The Mashpee Wampanoag themselves take in a lot of money. They use that to pay for lawyers and lobbyists and the like to move their chances forward, ultimately not knowing where it's going to fall. So to continue that analogy, it looks like their bet is paying off, at least to this stage. They've got a long road to go still. They still have to reach agreements with the federal government, although, again, this is making it look a lot better for them. They also have to reach an agreement with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that the federal government feels is adequate. They thought they had reached a deal with the state last summer, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs said, that deal doesn't work for us. We feel that the tribe is giving too much away to the state in terms of revenue, essentially. The tribe felt it was a perfectly fair deal, and in fact, what they were getting out of it a lot was lobbying by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to the federal government. And sort of to get behind the curtain a little bit, we all know Governor Patrick is friends and a confidant of the president. That's a pretty good person to have whispering in an ear in Washington. So I think the tribe felt that was a good part of the deal. But ultimately, the BIA said, no, you got to go back to the drawing board, which they've now done. They're working on a deal, and they probably will be coming back to the feds very soon.
And it also means something for those folks that had expressed interest, not the Mashpee Wampanoags, but others who were thinking that, great, they won't get this federal approval and we can move in on this territory and build a casino. So that's going to slow down that possibility for anybody else until this is all worked out. So Paul, and I'm talking to Paul Pronovo, editor of the Cape Cod Times, and we're talking about news from the Cape, little local roundup of still things happening as a result of the blizzard on the Cape, or things not happening, rather. and we just talked about the Mashpee Wampanoag's latest good news for them. Got to ask you about Navy SEAL Gabriel Gomez, who has announced a run for the U.S. Senate. He'll be running as a Republican, opposing Dan Winslow, and he's from Cohasset. So what insight can you bring? What Cape insight can you bring to Gabriel Gomez?
Well, he obviously is a relative unknown in terms of the political circles in the GOP and including here on the Cape. You know, the Cape Republican Party recently said, look, we haven't even heard from Mr. Gomez, although we expect to very soon, though his resume, his pedigree seems very attractive to folks. And, you know, when you
let's recount that. He's a Navy SEAL. In fact, he's so much a Navy SEAL that he was an ambassador for the local formal organization here in Massachusetts, the Navy SEAL Foundation, representing Navy SEALs and all that they do and all of their skills. He has an MBA from the Harvard Business School and worked as an investment banking associate at Bowles Hollowell Connor in aerospace and defense, and then an equity firm, Summit Partners, and now he's a principal at the private equity firm Advent International. So that's very attractive, I would say.
That is very attractive. And, you know, when you're a political outsider, that can cut both ways. One way is that you have to get the name recognition, although he seems to be doing that very quickly. The other way is maybe you don't have the baggage that you inevitably develop as a career politician, and that will be helpful. It's a long road, and as we get to know this individual and the other candidates a little better, it's going to be an interesting campaign. You know, when Scott Brown surprised folks, I think, or surprised a lot of folks and said wasn't going to run, that really cleared the field. And we'll see where it goes. But this is certainly a candidate who I think we're going to get to know pretty well over the next few weeks and months.
He made his announcement on a video, a bilingual video. He is a first-generation American, by the way. I did note that, as you said, the local Republican Party there in the Cape didn't really know him that well, but he did run for the Cohasset Board of Selectmen and lost in 2003.
Right.
So he has some experience running, though that'll stand him in good stead as he starts his new campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because we have a former Nantucket selectman by the name of Doug Bennett, who now lives in Dorchester. I think he's a realtor in Dorchester.
We've interviewed him on Boston Public Radio.
So you know Doug.
Oh, Doug Bennett.
You know, uh-huh. Doug tends to be everywhere at the same time. Well, he's looking to get involved in this campaign as well. And you know, it's interesting because Doug really does put himself out there and build some name recognition. And yet here comes this other gentleman with virtually no name recognition, and already sort of the idea of him as a candidate seems to be catching fire. That's always a good sign in politics.
Oh, I think so, too. And I also think at this particular time in Massachusetts, where the Republican Party is really thinking of all kinds of ways to rebuild and go forward, a fresh face is really a fresh face. I mean, this is that gives him a leg up, if you will. If the party had been doing better, maybe he wouldn't get as much attention. But that adds to it as well, I think.
I think that's true, and I think that was one of the things that Scott Brown had going for him, although he wasn't a completely fresh face. He obviously had been a state representative and a state senator, but in terms of statewide recognition, it wasn't much. I mean, he was a guy from Wrentham, Massachusetts,
yeah.
So not many people knew him, and really he was, and he was, speaking of omnipresent, he was out there all the time, as we know, campaigning
very
hard, and that's what propelled him. So it'll be interesting to see what Mr. Gomez's campaign style is and how much we see him out there. I suspect, just again, as you mentioned his background, looking at that background, this sounds like someone who will be energetically campaigning.
And we'll be looking for the intimate portrait in the Cape Cod Times in the upcoming weeks.
So, you got it.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Paul Pronovo, editor of the Cape Cod Times. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kelly. Always a pleasure.
And Edgar B. Herwick III is back in the studio.
How you doing, Callie?
Mm-hmm.
So there was some big news recently out of the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Certain pope is going to sort of abdicate as pope. First time in about 600 years this has happened. So it's an interesting time for us to look into the priesthood, which ultimately anybody who becomes pope starts as a priest. And I think even for people who are Catholic, who were raised Catholic, it's a little bit of a strange institution, the priesthood. It's kind of a head-scratcher. And we're going to talk with author Gary Wills, who knows this inside and out, and is going to have a lot of an explanation of why it is so curious, because actually the history of the priesthood is kind of curious.
Hmm. Well, look forward to that. And take it away, Edgar Herwig.
Well, I will. That's Callie Crossley. I'm Edgar B. Herwig III.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
In stereo.